Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Communities of color in Boston are disproportionately affected by evictions. A new report from MIT and the housing advocacy group City Life Vita Urbana shows that Black communities are particularly vulnerable. Now, a state moratorium on evictions put in place due to the coronavirus pandemic is going to likely expire in mid-August, which means Black and brown renters could be facing massive housing vulnerability. With the next rent due date just around the corner on Wednesday, July 1st, we're going to delve into the implications of the report. Let's start with one of the co-authors. Joining us now is Justin Steele. He's an associate professor of law and urban planning at MIT. Justin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you worried about making rent? Are you a landlord who relies on rent to make your own mortgage and tax payments? Have you seen evidence in your own experience of racial bias in evictions? What's on your mind? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Justin, you did this report with some colleagues, David Robinson, Patricia Kafferke. Can you give us the top line of the report? What is the big finding for you?
I think there are two primary findings. The first is that 70% of market rate eviction filings are in census tracts where the majority of residents are people of color, even though only about half of the city's rental housing is in these areas. And even beyond that, 37% of market rate eviction filings occur in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are Black, even though only 18% of rental housing is in these neighborhoods. So that means that evictions are two times more likely in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are Black than we would expect if evictions were evenly distributed across the city. And so these disparities are related to socioeconomic status, but our statistical analyses find that even after controlling for census tract median household income, poverty rate, and the share of income paid to rent, eviction filings are still more likely to occur in census tracts where there's a larger share of Black renters.
Meaning that race can be explanatory.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I noticed you used the term market rate a couple of times there. Can you blow that out for us a little bit? Why are you using that term specifically, and what are the implications of the fact that these are market rate evictions, do you think?
Yes, yeah, so we focused on evictions in privately owned rental units that are rented at whatever the market rate is and wherever that apartment is or home is. And we excluded public housing and publicly subsidized housing, which is often privately owned but publicly subsidized, because we wanted to have a conservative estimate, because often because of policies about where public housing or subsidized and continuing policies about where or neighborhood opposition to the location of subsidized housing, you often have subsidized housing concentrated more in communities of color in Boston. And so we wanted to see for market rate units, looking more conservatively at just market rate units, is there still are there still racial disparities in eviction rates? And we found that there are.
So how do you define an eviction in this report? I know you used Boston Housing Court filings for your data.
Yes, so that's a very important point. We're focusing on eviction filings, and specifically filings that are filed in Boston Housing Court. And so that is a larger number than actually executed evictions, but it's a smaller number than the number of what are often called informal evictions. So many times landlords tell tenants that they want them to leave, or that they have to leave, or if they're overdue on their rent, that they have to leave without actually going to court to file an eviction filing. So in other research, other scholars have found that there may be twice as many informal eviction filings as formal ones. And then there's when landlords go to court to file for an eviction filing, if they do that, that's the numbers that we're analyzing. And not all of those end in an executed eviction, but often they end up in settlements kind of in the hallway of the courthouse outside the courtroom. But those settlements often end in tenants being forced out, even though it's not recorded as an executed eviction because they've settled it out of court.
So, Justin, you use data from 2014 to 2016. We're 4 years in a global pandemic later. Let's focus on the pandemic portion. How do you view your data through the lens of what's happening with COVID-19?
So we also did look at data for the roughly 7 weeks between the identification of the first COVID-19 case in Massachusetts and the implementation of the statewide eviction moratorium in April. And the racial disparities in eviction filings in that 7 week time period are actually even larger than they were in the 3 years that we studied previously. And during that time period, 78% of all evictions filed in Boston were filed in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are people of color, even though that's only about half of the rental housing units. So it suggests that in this time of extreme economic dislocation where many people have been laid off or unable to work the hours they need to maintain their incomes, that we're already, you know, even before the moratorium, we were starting to see that these disparities are getting wider. And I expect if the moratorium or when the moratorium is lifted, the racial disparities will be even more dramatic and troubling.
Well, that's Justin Steele, Associate Professor of Law and Urban Planning at MIT. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, to respond and offer his perspective, we want to bring in Doug Quattrocci, Executive Director of Mass Landlords, a trade group representing landlords in the state. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Doug.
Thank you, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
So, Doug, with this report, the map of where evictions are happening, it's pretty striking. Do you think racism or systemic racism play a big role in evictions?
Well, yeah. I mean, the report is not fundamentally surprising. We have a serious problem in America, and no less in Massachusetts, with a set of policies, housing policy included, that are systemically racist.
Doug, so, I've got a caller ready. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, if you had a second half to that thought, I think it's important that I hear it. So go ahead.
Well, I mean, the report is one thing, and the report that was published leads us to a set of conclusions which are basically not related to race, things like rent control, extending the moratorium, free attorneys for renters. I just wanted to say that I think if we're really going to address systemic racism in America and in the Commonwealth, we have to have policies that take race into account. In other words, we can't address a problem of racism with race-neutral laws.
Let's take a call from a caller who wants to talk about policy. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Steve on the line from Natick. Steve, go ahead.
Yes. I'm calling not only about the fact that there's racism and it's systemic in the state and the country, as well as other part of the world, but with regards to COVID-19, what's happening with that, and rent as well as mortgage payments. I was just wondering if anyone has floated the idea of giving people the option of putting those things on hold or perhaps just making partial payments to help cover, say, real estate taxes or water utilities. Because I remember from
Great, thanks
one,
for that.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me take it back from you there, Steve. Thank you, because there are some answers to that. And Doug, I know that you're aware of what some of the supports are for landlords. We've got an eviction moratorium at least until mid-August, and there have been some state funds to help people pay mortgages and rent. Are there other public policy initiatives that you're advocating for or want to see that will lessen the strain on both renters and landlords in terms of mortgage payments, rent payments, other financial liabilities?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of it reflects a lack of understanding of how housing providers operate, that we should be focused on extending mortgage forbearance or utility forbearance. So those things would matter. But when you're considering whether you should rent or buy, you know, you're looking at your rent and you're looking at the mortgage payment. The mortgage is half of the cost of running a building for a new building typically. You've got your mortgage, but you've also got insurance, taxes, repairs, utilities. And it doesn't really make sense to try to onesie-twosie figure out how to whack down expenses. What we really need is just to have the state come in and guarantee that all of these rental housing costs will be paid for. No one should have to leave their home at any point, even after a moratorium ends. So the money piece of it is really important, not just because we're landlords and we're greedy. That's a stereotype, right? Housing isn't free. And these expenses, especially municipal taxes, which pay for infrastructure and first responder budgets, these are really important. And the state has to come up with an answer for how those costs are going to be paid.
I'd like to grab one more call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Mitchell on the line from Wellesley. Mitchell, go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to comment as somebody who owns a property and is being affected by the moratorium that I really don't think any landlords are looking to evict people who have been good tenants just because they're having some financial difficulties right now. The problem is that you've got an ongoing indefinite inability of landlords to recover rent from their tenants if they stop paying, with no help from the state to help with that. So the landlords have to continue paying their mortgages, property taxes, insurance, water for the tenants, maintenance on the buildings, but they don't have the money to do it. And so there's a lot of talk going on about imposing or extending the moratorium for up to a year, but that's really a devastating burden to put on the landlords who, you know, want to do right by their tenants, but at the same time have to be getting the income. And I'd
Mitchell,
be hoping
thanks.
To see some help from the state on that.
Thanks. Let me take it back from you there. There's a lot going on here, Doug, and we have limited time, so I want to kind of bundle that together in a two-part question to you. One, this report controls for a lot of variables and shows that unequivocally, based on the data, people who are people of color face higher chances of being evicted. We now have this pandemic that is creating cash flow crunches for both landlords and renters. We also know in the Boston Globe article over the weekend emphasized a couple of stories where people were facing potential eviction because of market rate housing rents were being raised before the pandemic. We are in a perfect storm here. What is the path forward that does not pit landlords and renters against each other and that recognizes, as you acknowledged at the beginning of our conversation, the systemic racism dimensions of how housing works?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's important that we look not to the recent past where some folks are saying rent control will help, because rent control had a known and measurable disparate impact on people of color. We had about 24% of our residents in Cambridge were people of color in the 70s and 80s, but only 12% of rent-controlled units went to people of color. And that's because of the systemic racism that maybe we don't have time to get into. But the big picture systemic racism that we really do need to address long-term is single-family zoning in the Commonwealth. Minneapolis recognized that their single-family zoning was, by origin, by intent, racist, and they had terrible things written to their deeds about who could live there. Massachusetts has been more circumspect about the origins of zoning, but we have the same policy baggage here. So this single-family zoning business needs to be addressed. And short-term, extending the moratorium is, as we heard earlier, just a way of kicking the can down the road past elections. We need funding. There needs to be funding to provide rental housing to all of us impacted by the pandemic, and it needs to be much bigger than anyone's talking about. We're talking about order of magnitude $1 billion, and the most I've heard anyone talk about coming up with is $50 million. So we tie those two together by proposing a transfer tax on single-family zoned property that would go into a fund that would pay for a rental housing guarantee that we need. We call that proposal a fair and equal housing guarantee via surety bonds.
I have to ask you, the gaps between those two numbers are so massive. Will something like your transfer tax proposal, could it close the gap? And if not, what is going to happen?
Yeah, it will. I mean, you look at people who study issues like the black-white wealth gap and how much money across the entire country is needed. And I've seen very careful work that says nothing less nationwide than $1 trillion of reparations or something similar is going to address this issue. In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we can realistically raise order of magnitude billions of dollars from a tax on single-family land. It's most of the housing that we have. Rental housing providers are an extreme minority, and renters are in a minority too. Most people have their own home in the Commonwealth, and that restrictive land use has really got us to the point where we have a housing crisis, and now that we've got a pandemic too, it's just looking really bad. So we need to be thinking big, and we need to be thinking about landscape-changing proposals.
Well, we can keep our eye on that proposal, and if and as it moves forward, we would obviously want to host a debate for all sides of that here on the air. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for your time today. That's Doug Quattrocci, Executive Director of Mass Landlords, which is a trade group representing landlords in the state. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So now we turn to Lisa Owens, who is the executive director of City Life Vita Urbana, a housing justice organization and part of the group that did the report that we began this segment with. Lisa, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
So Lisa, in a Globe article this weekend, you warned of a tsunami of evictions that are coming. How bad will this be?
It's bad. It's bad. So, you know, you had Justin on earlier, and based on the data that Justin shared, we know that the communities that will be hardest hit when the moratorium is lifted are the exact same communities that we feature in our report. And as probably most people know by now, Massachusetts Housing Court is estimating 20,000 eviction filings immediately. And so that really is, as you said before, a perfect storm. You know, when you think about the eviction moratorium possibly being lifted around the same time that we anticipate a second surge, knock on wood, it doesn't happen, but it is likely to happen. So yeah, it's pretty bad. And we have to act now, preventatively.
I don't mean to sound despairing, but are we capable of acting on the scale to be effective against a wave as big as the one you're talking about? And how do we get there?
So I want to remind us of the distant past, March 1st of this year. It seems like such a long time ago, but
it seems like another lifetime ago.
Seems like another lifetime ago, but you know, in March, the Massachusetts Homes for All Coalition, which brought just so many groups across the state, small homeowners, small landlords, renters, legislators, all came together and did what would have in other times been the impossible. We enacted in 5 short weeks the strongest piece of housing legislation I think that our state has seen in a decade. And that was because we all came together and we realized we have a public health emergency that we all have to figure out together. And you know, so the fact that we were able to do that at the beginning of the crisis makes me hopeful that we can actually enact even bolder change for homeowners and for tenants and small landlords together.
You know, there is a rally this weekend to extend the eviction moratorium. There's also legislation that'll be filed by 2 representatives in the State House to expand the moratorium by 12 months, providing mortgage deferment and funding for small landlords who lose rental income. So some things that could help bridge the gap caused by the pandemic. But this report talks about a set of issues that predated the pandemic, and one will believe if we don't make change post-date it, if it's even a way to imagine what a post-COVID world will look like. How do we get at those core issues, and how do we not get distracted from also addressing those core issues when we have such immediate and overwhelming need right in front of us from the pandemic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Our report does a really good job at naming how we got here in the first place, right? So naming what systemic racism looks like and how to dig ourselves as a city and as a state out of the hole that that we find ourselves in. And, you know, I guess I just have to say up front that racial justice is housing justice. So systemic racism is not individual level discriminatory behavior. Systemic racism is both the actions of private market actors writ large and public policy. So public policy that was race specific, like redlining, but also public policy like urban renewal and predatory lending, where you don't actually let the homeowners know I'm discriminating against you, or foreclosure, or gentrification. So private market actors plus public policy equals systemic racism, and you address the generational legacy of systemic racism with really good public policy that addresses the impacts, right? And so I think, you know, our report talks about a number of policy solutions. I want to uphold the one that you just referenced, Tiziana, the Act to Guarantee Housing Stability. that's going to be filed by Representatives Honan and Connolly tomorrow. So this act immediately supports the people in the communities who are going to be the hardest hit by the second surge. And immediately after the moratorium is lifted, it provides protections from COVID-19 related eviction and foreclosure. It provides a fund to specifically help working class homeowners, working class small landlords and renters to recover from their financial hardship. There are a number of provisions that will address immediately the hardships that we're going through now and provide protections for a year of recovery. That's really what we're hearing across the state. People need immediate protections and they need long-term recovery.
All right. Well, this is something we're going to continue to watch, and I hope we'll have you back on again soon, Lisa, to talk about it. That's Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana, a housing justice organization. Thanks for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Susanna.